Welcome to season 4, episode 7 of the FASD Family Life Podcast. This is the show for families by families raising children and youth with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. I'm your host, Robbie Seal. I'm an FASD educator, an advocate, and a mom of 5 incredible people, including 3 teens diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And if my 30 years of parenting has taught me anything, it's that the struggle is real and so is success. I hope that by sharing my experiences with you, you will feel that you're not alone and that there is hope for you and your kids with FASD. I am so thrilled to be with you today. Thank you for taking me along with you. If you enjoy the podcast, consider being a monthly sponsor. The podcast is supported by listeners like you. There's a link in the show notes to make it easy for you to do that. Did you catch my conversation with Miles Himmelreich, CJ Lutke, and Emily Hargrove? They are members of the Adult Leadership Committee of the FASD Changemakers, also lead researchers and authors of the Lay of the Land Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder as a Whole Body Diagnosis Study. We discussed their groundbreaking research that led to the discovery of the 428 comorbid conditions common with FASD. Their study changed the direction of FASD research around the world. And last week, my friend Dr. Jared Brown was back with a brand new series, Threats to Emotional Health. It was a fascinating conversation about irritability, a multifaceted issue that is not often talked about within the context of prenatal alcohol exposure. So make sure you subscribe now so you never miss another episode. You've heard me say this before, and I'm going to say it again. FASD is a significant global health issue that needs attention, which is why I decided to go on a world tour, as it were, to highlight the issue of FASD around the world, as well as the tremendous work being done to re-educate society of the risks of consuming alcohol during pregnancy. Also to advocate for systematic changes that would recognize FASD as a permanent disability and provide support for individuals and their families impacted by prenatal alcohol exposure. This week, it's my absolute pleasure to speak with the founders of FASD Ireland, Scott and Tristan Casson-Rennie, about FASD Ireland, which was established in September 2021 to be the go-to hub for everyone living with FASD, including their families, carers, educators, healthcare workers, and the wider community across Ireland. It's so inspirational. They work tirelessly to change and lobby government to legislate and implement practical strategies that will reduce and prevent FASD in Ireland. FASD Ireland is committed to raising awareness of FASD across the country, to break down barriers, and to be a catalyst for everyone with FASD to be able to live the life they strive for. FASD Ireland will be a loud voice and a persistent advocate for people living with FASD. We want to get Ireland talking about FASD and will work with all stakeholders to ensure that FASD is considered and respected in every walk of life. And there's a link in the show notes for you to learn more. Welcome to FASD Family Life, Scott and Tristan. I was so excited to learn of the advocacy work and the awareness work you're doing in Ireland. It wasn't very many years ago where there was really no awareness of FASD in Ireland. And I'm podcasting here from Canada, so it's a different situation. And even here in Canada, theoretically, there's knowledge of FASD, but we just feel like we're pushing uphill all the time too. You know, coming across people who've never heard of it before, who are not aware of risks of drinking during pregnancy, or what some of the challenges children in school are facing aren't maybe down to just a learning disability, ADHD or autism. But in fact, FASD is many, many times more common than those things. And also those disabilities present in FASD. I would love now to hear about your work in Ireland. So tell me about the organization and the stats and everything. Take it away.
Okay. Well, you caught me at a really relevant time because I've literally just finished sending an email to the Minister for Special Educational Needs. Yeah, we have one of those here now. And I met with her a couple of months ago and got down on both knees, effectively, to beg the minister to start recognising FASD as a disability. We have a real issue here in Ireland that we are the third highest by global prevalence of FASD, and yet the country doesn't recognise FASD as a disability. It's been extremely difficult. Where our organisation came from, well, you know, I think maybe you already know, but if for those listening that don't, Scott and I have a youngest child who has a diagnosis of FASD, and the support just wasn't there for our child. And through lockdown, I got incredibly frustrated. And in the end, on the 9th of September last year, which happened to be World FASD Awareness Day, I said, come on, I'm going to do this now. I'm going to set this organisation up. And it came from a little bit of, I suppose, a conversation with the local MP here. They're called TDs in Ireland, but MP. And they said to me, you know, as a parent, you're not going to have a very strong voice. If you set up an organisation, people will listen. And that's exactly what has happened. We set up on the 9th of September from home in a little room that we said we'll put a computer in. And now we have offices in the town centre. We run lots of training workshops, and we have, you know, online, we have visitors. We engage with the HSE, which is our health service here. They meet with us regularly and they talk with us about, you know, how we're getting on, what life is like for people that we represent now, the families that contact us daily. And they ask for our feedback. We have the only national database of people living in Ireland with FASD, which, you know, it took us 6 months to start to build that up, and it's growing. So the last 6 to 7 months for us have been extremely busy. We literally threw every penny of savings into the organisation that we had. Crazy, I guess, leap of faith, I guess. But in doing so, in having the offices, it allowed us then to be able to work with other community groups and use some of the space to recover some of that money as well. So not only do we, you know, advocate for people with FASD, but we also now provide a community space for other groups to be able to meet in, and that helps to cross-fund us so that we can stay afloat. So that's where we came from. I guess that's where we are. And, you know, ask away. We've got lots of stories to tell.
Don't we all have lots of stories to tell? I was saying to Scott before we began recording that so often that is the case. These big initiatives, these brand new initiatives that get started with such passion are so often rooted in the family who can't find the resources, the family that feels so alone and is begging, like you said, down on two knees, begging for supports for our kids, begging that our kids be recognized, and struggling with the teachers and doctors who've never heard of FASD before. So struggling with them to try to educate them. And it so often comes from parents who step into the gap where there was a need. And it sounds that's exactly what you did. That's what I did too. I, you know, as a parent and of four adopted children, three diagnosed with FASD, and just still feeling so alone here in Canada, where, you know, to you, it feels like FASD is really well known, but we still struggle just like all parents do. And it was confounding behaviors and all your best practices of parenting, all your best things that you knew to be parents just don't work. And you feel so alone. And that's why I started the podcast was, hey, you know, I know that you feel alone, and let me share with you that the struggle is real. And so is success. We have to change our paradigm. How was that for you guys? When did you realize FASD was a factor in your son's life? What was your aha moment to this is a disability? This is not willful bad behavior.
I mean, I think that's been a journey, shall we say. I mean, bear in mind, we have two older children who were adopted as well. And in the grand scheme of things, it was just not, it seems now just normal parenting.
Normal
adoptive parenting. You know, we didn't know a lot of things when we went through the initial process. We were more focused in on getting through the process to be able to adopt. And the law had just changed. We were the first same-sex couple that went through the agency. So there was a lot of work for them to do. And that was our focus. So we had no clue about anything until we went for the preparation training, which, to be honest, we were very ignorant to it all. And what I mean by that is we just went, well, when they come to us, it'll be fine. You know, we'll fix them, we'll help them, etc. But the first two, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, almost angels.
Their halos were a little tilted, but almost angels. How old were they when they came to you?
So they were 7 and 8 when they came to us, nearly 8 and 9. So they were older as well. And, you know, that's quite a, back then, that was quite a newish thing here in the UK as well, to be able to adopt older children. The maximum age really you would be looking at is age 10 here. We were there was lots of discussions around it being unsuccessful and failing and all that sort of stuff, rather than looking at how it could succeed. And I think our stubbornness took over then. When the boys were placed with us, we were determined that they were never going to be let down by us, despite what anybody says. And, you know, there was lots of things said. But then roll forward 7 years, the boys were, I think they were 15, 16. We were in the process to becoming foster carers. Our plan was to foster as the boys got that little bit older. I was the stay-at-home dad, and we did that. We were approved as foster carers, and then all of a sudden we were contacted by the agency that the boys had been placed by, asking us if we were looking to add to our family. And we mentioned that we were going to become foster carers. And then, despite our request not to send us a photograph of this little boy, they decided to send us a photograph of this little boy. And
knew what they were doing.
There's no strategy involved there.
Yeah, they knew our Achilles heel when it came to that. So, essentially, that went quite quick after that, because he was able to be placed with us really quickly because we were already foster carers. The kind of reports that we received from on him, we weren't quite so naive. We weren't quite as, you know, as dismissive of some of the kind of behaviors, some of the health issues that came with it. But nowhere, no point was there any mention of kind of FASD or addiction or anything like that. So when he was first, when he was first placed, and I think he's just delivered a cup of tea here. So hopefully if he is listening, then he's getting positives out of this. Oh, he's got his headphones on. Okay. I forgot my train of thought there, but he came to us
He had 51 different labels, 51 different diagnoses. Yeah. So when we talk
Wait a minute. He was how old? 10 years old?
He was only 7.
Seven, and he had 51 different diagnoses.
Yeah, so when we talk about you know, the comorbidities of FASD having 428, we had a 7-year-old who had 51 of those.
Yeah.
At least that was what the practitioners that had just snowballed his whole life since he was in the care system from a very young age. And every single practitioner had said, oh, no, he doesn't have ADHD, he's got Tourette's. He doesn't have Tourette's, he's got ASD. You know, every single possible label that a 7-year-old could have, he came equipped with.
Yeah.
Equipped with.
Yeah. And what was interesting was, for the first, you know, there was obviously reports from his previous foster carers who were retiring. A lot of that, we didn't see any of the behaviours that they had reported in the first 6 to 8 months.
We call that a honeymoon.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was a honeymoon period. And the only small thing was incessant chatter. Because he does not stop talking, or he didn't. He's a little bit more relaxed now, and we thought that was our biggest problem, was actually his food intake and his verbal skills, because he has amazing verbal skills. He is so intelligent. He is way, you know, more intelligent than I wouldn't say either of us, but yeah, probably both of us. Trying to contain that in a 7-year-old is really difficult. You know, he would rather sit and watch a news channel than he would watch cartoons. You know, that was kind of his, that was the baseline that we were kind of dealing with. And it wasn't until we were on a short break. So we were away from home. And that's really where it all started. I guess you could say unravel. You know, there was violence towards us. There was physical and verbal, you know, running off, you know, all that kind of, all the stuff that we started to see that had been reported previously started to creep into our lives as well. And of course, we thought we were on our own. We thought that it was our fault that he was physical with us. We thought that perhaps we had done something wrong, et cetera, et cetera. So it took us a while. I think it took us a year to actually go, okay, that's enough is enough now. We can't keep on going on like this. We have to do something. So by the time he was 8 and a half, that's when we started to realize that there was something underlying here. And FASD, we'd been warned, but someone had, one of our friends who was a social worker, we'd asked her to read his file for us because we were foster carers. We didn't have an adoption agency representative. So we asked her to read his file as our friend, and she did. And she said, I've only got one thing really that I want to make you aware of, and that is the potential for FASD. And whilst he doesn't have a lot, or he didn't have a lot of facial features, there was a couple of things that she noticed from his photograph that may have had, may have kind of were a contribution to FASD.
And so, of course, we know now, because we're in a different world, we've made it our lives, I suppose. But we know now that FASD features, you know, they appear between the ages of 11 and 15. So, you know, a young person is only going to start to present some of those characteristics when they're on the cusp of leaving primary education and going into secondary education. And of course, we know that those years are mixed up with the onset of adolescence, the confusion of changing schools, of making new friends, of finding out who they are. So there's all of that going into that melting pot, as well as they might have FASD, you know. And we have evidence, of course. We didn't have evidence initially, but we have evidence of alcohol consumption through, you know, in utero. So once you have that, then everything starts to point towards, oh, my child may have FASD. We now need to go down that diagnosis pathway. And that diagnosis pathway isn't the yellow brick road. It's far from it. You know, I don't know anybody who's actually gone from zero to full diagnosis with very little struggle. I think that's a battle that all of us have to go through, and we have to keep, you know, beating that drum. And along the way, the CAMHS, the Child Adolescent Mental Health Service, were saying, no, he can't have FASD. He doesn't have the facial dysmorphia. So that was a struggle. And then, you know, you get past that kind of gatekeeper and you challenge again, and you do meet these people along the way that then go, actually, yes, he does have FASD. And so it's a roller coaster ride of does he, doesn't he, does he, doesn't, you know. And you get to the point then when you get that piece of paper that says, we confirm he has a diagnosis of FASD, and you take a big, big breath and you go, okay, that was worth the effort. It was worth the battles. But, oh my goodness, what do we do now? We have the diagnosis, but now we have to work out what happens next. And there's a huge void for everybody once they have that diagnosis. It's a bit like a big anticlimax, because you've got it, but then you have to say, okay, what does it mean for us? And, you know, that's where the birth of FASD Ireland came from, because there was just nothing. Teachers and doctors and professionals were saying, what is FASD? You know, even the GP was, what, FASD? What type of autism is that? That was mm-hmm. the first question I was asked by the GP when we registered here. And it was horrifying. You know, we were fortunate in our local CAMHS office here, the Child Adolescent Mental Health Service, that the specialist that was assigned to our youngest son actually did her her degree about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. So we were fortunate, we were blessed with that person looking after our youngest. But had we not have had that person, I think we would have really struggled. School had never heard of it. They saw him as a perfectly usual adolescent child who was just a bit naughty. You know, that naughty label creeping in. He was a little bit defiant, you know, a little bit mouthy, could be argumentative, obstructive, disruptive. But, hey, that's just normal for kids in Ireland. You know, every class in Ireland has two or three of these kids.
Why is this normal for Ireland, right?
Exactly right. But if you've got 4.75% of the population with FASD, then the chances are in a class of 30 children, two, maybe three of them will have FASD. So that's why it's normalized that, you know, we have this in school.
He's just one of that group of kids.
Yeah.
So my goodness, I'm nodding my head vigorously because I just agree with all of these things. And I remember fighting to get that diagnosis. And I remember, so my twins, they went through the same year, different months. So, you know, all that work, I did that three times over. That's a lot of work to all the forms you have to fill out and all the fighting and advocacy you have to do. And I remember when they got the diagnosis, I sat alone in that conference room with all the experts because here it's a multidisciplinary team that provides that examination and diagnosis. Yeah. And I was a single parent and I sat alone in that room listening and listening and listening. And I felt relief that there was that confirmation. Okay, now we have a label. Now I know what I need to learn about. And I felt utterly gutted because this is what I thought it was. And now I know it is. And this is a lifelong disability.
Yes.
So there's that grief that goes with it as well.
Yeah. And I think that in terms, so part of our journey to becoming parents, obviously when you're adopting, you're what you deem that may be negative in your life is actually a positive. So some of the kind of the experiences you had as a child maybe may have a positive impact on your parenting skills. And I think that's where with FASD Ireland, yes, our main thing is about supporting families and people who have FASD, but also there's the mental health element on all of this as well. There's also the kind of addiction side, homelessness, you know, all of these kinds of things. And I think that's potentially what we want to, well, that's kind of my role within FASD Ireland is looking for those communities to bring them inside so that we can make them more aware of FASD. You know, we had we did training for one agency who wanted to bring in so she was she trained as a psychologist in the UK and she came to Ireland and she knew about FASD from the UK. She came to Ireland, nobody knew who it was. Half of her outreach clients have FASD. They've not been diagnosed with it, but she just knows. She knows that they have FASD because of their histories, because of their backgrounds, because of their behaviors. And when we came on the scene, it was like, wow, okay, you're here now. So where do we take this? How do we go? And it's not, you know, the diagnosing process isn't easy. But if we can just make people more aware that there are other conditions that aren't just ADHD, autism, Tourette's, etc., then that's half the battle in terms of raising awareness, because we have to raise awareness in a country that isn't aware of it.
That's, you know, right. And first of all, we have to raise awareness and while we do that, break down the stigma.
Yeah.
No shame, no blame. I know you guys talk about that all the time. So do I. Oh. No shame, no blame in Canada. And I know you say this too. FASD is a diagnosis for two. Really, it's a diagnosis for the whole family. Yeah. Often it's generational. So this is a diagnosis for the whole family. And while we may identify a young person or a young adult with FASD, so they need support. And of course, like you said, Scott, the mental health component, that's an issue for that individual's FASD, but also the families. Is there also FASD further up in the family tree? But even if not, if you're caring for a person with FASD or behavioral and these neurobehavioral disabilities, it's a wear and tear on your own emotional well-being and your own mental health. So families need a lot of support. They need training. They need coaching. They need professional counseling to acknowledge the grief and the struggle that they have. Be they their biological family, foster or adoptive family, this is all really hard.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, one of the key considerations here in Ireland is that about 90% of the people with FASD live in their biological families. So that's a real flip from the UK, where it would be 90% of people with FASD are coming to care experienced people instead. So here, the difficult question is always, who's going to ask that question? You know, if we identify, so here's an example. I deliver workshops into schools, to special needs assistants, to special needs coordinators. So I will typically go into a school, deliver a 2.5-hour workshop about FASD in the classroom. Before I start that, I will ask the school, the teachers, how many pupils are in your class, in your school with FASD? And typically they'll say none. I'll deliver the workshop, and 2.5 hours later, I will invite them to walk around the school and identify the children now that they believe have FASD. And they will always say, you know, if it's a school of 600, we'll estimate there's 30 students. But the big question at the end of that is, what do I do with that information? You know, how do I now talk to the parents and say, okay, I have concerns about your child. There may be FASD involved here. Mm-hmm. Were you drinking alcohol when you were pregnant? You know, and that's just not a question that can be asked very easily, if at all. And so my advice is always to these teachers and the special needs assistants, my advice is always, you now recognize that the child may have FASD. So in your mind, the child may have some of the comorbids that we talked about. Some of the strategies that I've also talked about in that session, you can now put into practice with that, those children. So they may not have a diagnosis, but at least now you can identify how you can support them. 100%. And if we deliver that across the entire school, what it helps to do is it helps to keep those children in education, but not just the children with question mark FASD, but perhaps that child who's come into school that morning, whose mum and dad have been fighting, or whose mum is on her own and has three uncles visiting every other day of the week, or whose dad is quite violent at home and the child has witnessed that. I'm going through stereotypes here, so don't pin me down on them. But what I mean by that is, if we can support a child in education with FASD, then we can support all of the children in school who don't have those labels, who haven't been flagged, who just have a disruptive home life, because the strategies are the same.
Agreed. If you're using these brain-based strategies, these neurobehavioral strategies that we talk about from Diane Malbin's work, the brain-based strategies, then we're serving all the children very well. Yeah. Diagnosis, no diagnosis, disability, no disability, because it's a very compassionate view. If there's a problem, if the child isn't doing well, what is this behavior or struggle communicating to us? And what part of the brain might be impacted? And we know trauma mm-hmm. impacts the brain, and a disruptive home life is traumatic. And yes. So that's going to just disrupt brain development, and that's going to cause a lot of struggles for these kids. So if we can be compassionate at school instead of piling on, well, if you would just try harder, if you would sit still, you know, my goodness, why didn't you get your homework done? Well, the kid's not going to say, because mom and dad were fighting last night, or because so-and-so was passed out on the couch, or because my big brother brought his gang friends home. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in families. And I mean, some of this crazy stuff goes on in my family because I've got, you know, 5 kids and 3 diagnosed with FASD. And so, you know, yeah, the police have been here, and yeah, kids have run off and things get loud and crazy and stressful. So I tell teachers, we don't do homework here because they've worked hard enough all day at school.
We do the same.
I think that we have a number of avenues to explore in Ireland now that we exist. What strikes me the most is that we do get daily contacts from people who are suddenly becoming aware that they may have FASD and what what happens next. So I'll give you a typical example of one of the communications I got through email through our website. And it was a guy who lives in Dublin. He's in his late 30s. He has a diagnosis of FASD, and he wanted to claim one of the disability allowances. So in order to do that in this country, you have to take that document to your GP, and your GP has to sign and stamp the form to say that, yes, you do have whatever you've written on the form. So off he goes to the GP and says, can you sign and stamp my form? And the GP looked at it and said, I can't possibly sign and stamp that. You've put that you've got FASD. You're in your late 30s. FASD only affects babies. So that crossed our door here, and we had a long conversation about that. The very next day, I had a meeting with the HSE, which is our health service, and in particular, the public health alcohol team, who I work very closely with. And I explained that very story to them, and they said, oh, we are in disbelief. We are going to put a circular out as a result of you sharing that straight away across all GPs in the country, telling them that FASD affects people. It's lifelong brain damage. It's lifelong disability. And they did that. And that's, you know, as essentially that's one of the great jobs that we do, is that we can share that life experience with the people that are in decision-making jobs, who to the best will in the world think that everything is lovely out there, but actually the lived experience tells us otherwise. So we can have that impact, we can make that change, we can help that to happen. And so it is about, for us, it's about re-educating society now. I can take you back to 1950s Ireland, where, you know, a typical maternity ward in a hospital, there'd be the rattle of the trolley as the trolley is going through the ward, and there would be bottles of Irish stout on the trolleys, and they'd be handing these out to the women while they're pregnant, saying, you need to drink this so you don't, and the baby doesn't get anemia. So that's only in the 50s. That's only 70 years ago. We know that this was happening even 50s, 60s, 70s Ireland. And so society believes that it's okay to drink alcohol through pregnancy. 82% of women in Ireland drink alcohol through pregnancy. That doesn't mean that they're alcoholics. It doesn't mean that they're binge drinking. It just means that they might have one glass of red wine every Friday night because they've finished work, and think that there's absolutely no problem with that. And so one of our key reasons of existence is to educate and to raise awareness and to prevent FASD. You know, there's not many organisations in the world who set themselves up to want to not exist. But if we can reduce FASD to zero in this country, then that's our job done. But I don't see that happening in my lifetime, and I've got another 50 years to give, I hope. But
no, we all. I have another 50 years.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, it is about, you know, our job is about saying we need to re-educate society that it's not okay to have a drink when you're pregnant. It's not okay for the lady. It's not okay for the man. You know, it's absolutely not okay. If you are planning to conceive or you are already pregnant, then stop. And that is the message that we have agreed that we put out alongside our colleagues at the public health team in the health service. We have to put out a consistent message. One of the struggles we have here, which you guys in Canada are doing very well at, is that there was legislation passed here in 2018. It's the Public Health Alcohol Act, and it stated, and it was committed to statute here, that all containers of alcohol must carry a warning advising people not to drink when pregnant. That has never, ever been implemented in this country, yet it sits on statute. It's currently up in the European courts because a couple of countries in the EU have objected to those warnings. And it's expected that it's going to come back to Ireland around 2024. So that's 6 years that act has been on statute but not been implemented. The worrying thing is that the last World Health Organization estimate for Ireland is that 600 plus babies every year are born with FASD. So there's 3,500 babies there that unnecessarily are born with FASD because that act, which is on statute, has never been implemented. We lobby with members of the Dáil Éireann, which is our parliament. We lobby with members of the Senate here to try to get them to put some force behind implementation. We'd love to talk to the alcohol industry to get them to just do it, you know, to just step up to the plate and do it. But there's all sorts of politics at play. So we as an organisation are not allowed to talk to the alcohol industry, because if we did that, then the health service wouldn't be allowed to work with us. So we have to kind of position ourselves so that we're best friends with everybody, but we don't really admit it. They're the politics that are at play. You know,
well, and isn't that the frustrating thing is, you know, you're trying to lobby for the well-being of all these unborn children, but who grow up and who live with this disability their whole life. This isn't just about babies. We talk about babies and children because everybody loves babies and children, and they're vulnerable, and it catches our heart. But these are individuals who live their whole life.
Yes.
50, 60, 70, 80 years and have this disability, and all across the lifespan require support. Yet so many people in your country and mine don't know that what kind of supports are so imperative. And with support, we know, and I know you've talked about this too, with the right support, individuals with FASD can do very well. There's always these comorbidities. There's always struggles. But then when we can build on the strength and can build the scaffolding and the support around the disability, then we can really change outcomes for kids. And we don't have this, let's talk about the revolving door in school. You know, if kids aren't fitting well in school, it's like wearing shoes that are the wrong size and you've got blisters all over your feet. How long are you going to wear those shoes?
Yeah.
After a while, you're going to kick them off and go, forget it. This hurts. And that's how it is for school. Forget it. It hurts. I don't need to be called stupid anymore.
Yeah.
Let's talk about school.
Well, I was just going to say as well, when they reach certain milestones, and this isn't the case for all children or young people with FASD, because there are different severities to it. And, you know, I know somebody who will never be independent who has FASD. I'm very grateful. I know an adult with FASD who lives in the UK, very independent, has his own children, has issues with addiction. But I also know our 15-year-old is very aware of himself. He's very aware of his own limitations. He's a typical 15-year-old. He likes to act like he's 30 most days. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, he can say, I can't do that. And I know why I can't do that. And, you know, the cracker the other week was, not that I'm short-tempered at all at the moment, but I kind of was a little bit kind of narky with him. And he said to me, he said, you know you shouldn't ask me to do that because I can't. And I went, oh, yeah, got to check myself there a little bit.
Because my kids do the same thing.
And he's right. The one thing that he is keen on is being independent, as in eventually being independent. And he is striving to make the effort to do that. There are some things that, you know, he may never be able to do. I mean, he will be on an episode of Hoarders in the future, because he loves to collect things. He's like a magpie. He likes things. It could be anything. It doesn't matter what it is. If it's shiny, if it's sparkly, if it means something to him, it will be taken, it will be kept. But what he also does is he is very aware of the fact that he wants to become independent. So he will try his best to make sure that that is going to happen for him. He'll be driving very soon, which, you know, our older two have just literally passed a test at the age of 23 and 22. He wants to do that because he wants to be independent. That's something we will have to I don't know how I feel too much about that. The kind of the complexities of someone who gets distracted very easily sitting behind a wheel in the car. But those are the kinds of things that he is very aware of. But that's not for everybody, of course. But, you know, the fact that he wants he's striving towards independence means that, you know, we have the correct support for him to be able to be like that and potentially to be independent at some point.
Sorry, if I may just say this, what we try to, the languaging in Canada is interdependence. like an interdependency, so that an individual is like your son, has the awareness of his own disability and his limitations, and can say, I can't do that. I can do this, but I need help with this. And that's kind of, you know, and so it isn't the idea of keeping our kids dependent on us and a kind of this learned helplessness. Goodness sakes, no parent wants that. Like, would you please move out? You know, but we have to just, I always say, slow your roll. Our kids grow and they do mature on a different trajectory, a different timeline. So we just have to slow it down. And like, you, 15 years old, FASD, highly distractible, perhaps not the best time to have a driver's license. 21, maybe. 35 might be better.
Maybe
public transit would be the way to go. I don't know. Sorry to interrupt you, Tristan. What were you going to say there?
Well, you'll see behind me on the wall the image of the sunflower. And I know in Canada you probably have seen it a few times.
I have.
So the sunflower is for people with hidden disabilities. And, you know, FASD is the hidden disability. And what we've done as an organization is we've partnered up with the Hidden Disability Sunflower so that we hope that eventually people with FASD can wear the sunflower lanyards as they're going about their daily business, whatever it is they're doing, whether they're in school or whether they're at work or whether they're shopping or flying through an airport. And that will allow them, the confidence to be able to live independently. Because, you know, often we're asked as parents, what does success look like? Particularly as adopters, you know, what does success look like? And the only answer I can ever give you for that is the success for us is to know that our child can live independently when we're no longer here. Because I would not wish for any one of our children to not be able to live independently when we're gone.
What do you say, though, to those parents who are biological parents or adoptive parents or grandparents parenting again, whose child is so profoundly impacted by FASD that living independently would be a danger to them? Or not possible, then we have a different measure of success.
Absolutely, we do. Yeah. And it's about, you know, again, this is about succession, isn't it? It's about when we're not here, we worry now in the here and now about the future. So when we're not here, we want them at least to have a quality of life that is reflective of what we can provide when we're here. Beautiful. And, you know, yes, there are definitely people who won't be able to live independently, but we've already said, and I'm going to use your words, where we have the right scaffolding, where we have the right framework, where we have the right supports in place, it is possible for people to have some level of independence still.
Yes. For most part.
And I think that's really important. And I think, you know, the issue, the scary part of Ireland right now is that these young people, and they are in the main, they are young people, are being written off at the age of 14 or 15 when they can leave school here, because it's a younger age that they can leave school. So they're being cast aside. They've been ostracized by their peer group because they've been labeled naughty in school. They've been cast aside by their family because they didn't stay at school and they're under their feet and they can't go out and get a job and pay their way. So they start to fall through the cracks of society. Society won't support them because they can't write to fill in the forms and they don't have a mobile telephone number or they don't have an address. So they end up homeless. They turn to crime. They fill up the prisons, the judicial system. They become society's problem, society's cost. They go in a prison, out of prison. And eventually, you know, their lives to them are just worthless. They just don't see any light at the end of the tunnel. And that's where we come in as an organization to say, at these young ages of 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, we go into school and we talk about FASDs with teachers, with the support teachers, with the students themselves, so that they understand it, so they can spot it, they can identify which of their friends, you know, might have this thing called FASD, and it hopefully will lead to these children being almost embraced and cared for by a part of society that previously has just turned a blind eye and ignored them as they've fallen through the cracks.
Exactly what we need to do. And there's other organizations that call, let's say, like FASD and Embrace Our Journey. Jeremy Elliott is a is a godfather who is caring for his godson. And that's his motto, is kind of embrace our journey. And he's taken that to the pro wrestling ring, and he wears his red boots to raise awareness. Jody Culp in the US has, you know, talk about embraced, and there's a film project in the US called Embraced. And that's what we're talking about. We like every single person deserves dignity and needs to be treated with full humanity. And that disability, no disability, everybody is entitled, you know, the rights of the child, right? By the United Nations, everybody is entitled to an education, to safe home life, to understanding, and the rights of the disabled person must include those with FASD.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll go right back to the very start when we started speaking, the Minister for Special Educational Needs here today has announced an act of law that says that every school has got to set up a special needs class. And that raised an eyebrow for me, because it's fine. I think it's a great idea. Let's have the special needs classes. You know, if we've got a problem in society where we don't have the educational capacity right now, so that the quick fix is to say every school needs to have a class so that at least we can educate all of these students. That's great. But let's recognize FASD first. Let's recognize that there is more than just one type of neurodevelopmental disability. Let's recognize all 10 types. Let's make sure that FASD is on the list. We can't just celebrate that we're opening up classes for students with disabilities when we don't recognize some of the disabilities.
Because then we get it wrong in terms of what the supports are, and then we still are creating a bad fit for individuals. Yes, yes, absolutely. So you started September 9th. Was that September 9th, 2021?
Yes.
My goodness. So not even a year. And look at what you've accomplished. What are you most proud of? What are you most frustrated with? And what's your goal for the next year?
So the goal for the next year is really easy. We have just won a place on the Social Entrepreneurs of Ireland Ideas Academy, and that started this week. And the idea that we've put forward is for a national FASD hub. We want to operate a helpline 7 days a week, all year round, for people who are touched by FASD, who live across the island of Ireland. And so that's where I see certainly the next 12 months of where we would like to be. It's impossible for us as a small organisation on the west coast of Ireland to be able to reach the whole country as we are if we stand still. So to now be able to have a good opportunity, a good chance to set up a national FASD hub, that will just be amazing, because part of the struggle we face is awareness, is raising awareness. And we need to be on the tip of everybody's tongue in this country. So I think that will help us. In terms of struggles, well, funding is always on everybody's minds. Money is scarce. The economy is in free fall. But I'd like to think that the model that we have is very good. It's very strong. We are funded for the next 5 years, thanks to partnerships that we've been able to foster on our journey over the past few months. Of course, there will be challenges, bumps in the road as we go ahead. No doubt, you know, we will need to take on some staff to help us as we grow. And every time we take on somebody, we have to take a deep breath and tighten our belt just that little bit more. But I mean, you know, that's exciting, really, I suppose. Scott, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think for me, the pride element is actually being accepted onto this Social Entrepreneurs of Ireland, because I think that, you know, 450 odd people applied to do that, and we are in the top 50 or the final 50 of that to go through to the next stage. It's a little bit like, I don't know, X Factor or I would say Britain's Got Talent or something.
Yeah,
like that. But I think for me, I struggled to find where my place would be in FASD Ireland. And obviously there's been a few stop starts health-wise with that this year. However, we're there. And I think achieving the goal of opening our offices is a big thing, because What it does is, for me, it brings a community of like-minded individuals together. We're all there, we're all doing our own thing, but actually to be able to bring everybody together, and we're only just starting out on this, but you know, we're kind of gradually building it. And that is my role. My role has always been engagement and kind of the operational side of things. And Tris is kind of more about the, what was it called? Kind of campaigning and stuff like that. Yeah. So I think that in terms of where we are, we fit really well. And I think in 12 months' time, I'd love to see my offices being used every day by these community groups to be able to support people. You know, right now, well, every Wednesday we have a local drug and alcohol addiction service. They have their base there. They have people in. You know, we're helping people with that. On a Saturday evening, we have a suicide prevention group in who, you know, will accept, who will just, you know, support people who knock on the door saying that they're feeling suicidal. Those are the kinds of things I'd like to think are our achievements to just to start with, as well on top of, you know, the foundations of FASD Ireland. So in 12 months time, I'd like to see it full, so that we're helping everybody in the community who's a little bit different, who doesn't maybe fit in where they think they should.
And what that does too, by opening your facility to all these different agencies, it makes you are now, they are now aware of you. And so now you're raising the conversation and awareness of FASD. What it also does is link all these organizations together so that they're not so siloed, and you become aware of one another, and you can cross-reference and cross-support, you know, okay. And that's so helpful, because sometimes you work with a young person or a person and they need whatever services. Maybe they need detox, or maybe they need mental health support, or maybe it's suicide, or maybe it's behaviors at school, or it's a family that's really struggling and saying, I can't keep this kid anymore. What am I going to do? If you're all working together, then they might come to one of those organizations and say, hey, you need to talk to Tris, or hey, you need to talk to these guys. Right. And that's really important, because it takes a whole village.
Yeah.
To support individuals who are in need.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That's agreed. Lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely. What's your plan for September 9th, FASD Day?
Well, it's our first anniversary, so we're going to have a bit of a party. But we've also been asked to work with the health service here to produce an awareness campaign ready for the 9th of September. Hidden Disabilities, the Sunflower people, have asked to do a conversation with us, and that's going to go on their global platform. And they are, along with us, going to wear red shoes all that day across their team. So from their marketing team to their printing team to the CEO, everybody will be wearing red shoes that day. So we've got a number of events, and we've also been asked to take part in a couple of podcasts and interviews in the run-up. So they're going to go in the can for that day, because we're just going to be a bit busy, I guess. Yeah. But we want to take some time for ourselves as well, just to, you know, sit back and look over our shoulder, see where we've come in the last 12 months, and just take some time to reflect on where we are. I certainly hope that one of the announcements that we hope to make on the 9th of September will be the launch of the National FASD Hub. So, you know, I don't think it's unrealistic. I think that we have to work hard, and we have to focus on how, you know, the strategy, the how to. But I do believe that it's got to be one of the must haves for going forward in the autumn and winter.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for spending this time with me. I've been so excited to be speaking with you both and learn more about the work you're doing in Ireland. Just think, it's less than a year old, and all you've done already, all the energy you still have. I'm glad to hear also you're taking at least a moment to take stock and reflect and maybe rest for a weekend. I don't know how long you can take off. That's about it, because you got to go, go, go. But, you know, it's exciting to start this new adventure and to be raising awareness. And I'm sure you get letters from people all the time, or emails from people like, I didn't even know. I had no idea that FASD was there, or thank you for the work you're doing. And I want to say thank you for the work you're doing as well. I invited you on FASD Family Life to do just that, to raise awareness of the work you are doing in Ireland. So very pleased for you and proud of you and excited along with you. Highlights of FASD all over the world to really raise awareness. We're not alone there, and that this is a global issue, and And that way, for the people who are listening to this podcast, they can find out that, okay, there is support in Ireland. So brilliant. Thank you so much. And
of course, I will promote on my podcast as well. So.
Maybe I'll be a guest on your podcast.
Well, you never know.
No, you never know. I'm just going to self-invite myself. I'm Canadian. I might do that. We'll have a cup of coffee together.
Yeah, it's interesting because today we should have been flying to Canada today to a delayed wedding. My cousin is getting married in Ontario this weekend, and all the family are at the airport this morning. And of course, we can't go because of the things going on in my head. So I've been visiting Canada since I was four years old. So
have you? Because you have family here.
Yeah, and all the all three of the boys have been like the older two boys used to come twice a year. So I do miss Canada because of this pandemic world that we live in at the minute. So hopefully, once my head is sorted, we can.
You said earlier in the podcast you've had some aneurysms this year, Scott.
He's had two aneurysms on a Sunday morning in March. And by the time he got to the airport, the hospital, he was flown by helicopter to the hospital. And by the time he got to the hospital, he'd had two more. So he had a total of four aneurysms, and it was touch and go for 48 hours to the point I had to fly the oldest child over from England, and they told me to get the family together because he wasn't going to make it. It was very touch and go at that point, scary times, you know, but
you made it through, and
we're 3 months on. So months on, he started to live a little bit more independently himself now, which is really good.
Yeah. I'm sure his energy is depleted then too. And his own capacities are depleted. So it's hard to parent from that position as well.
What I did learn myself was that having an adult in the house with a brain injury was a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a challenge that I wouldn't have been very good at dealing with had I not have been a parent to a child with FASD. Because all of the strategies that I use with our youngest son, I had to use with Scott when he came out of hospital. And for a number of weeks, I used to laugh and say, you are like a petulant child. But actually, it was the brain injury. It was the neurons not finding the right places in his brain. They weren't going, you know, they were going like a pinball machine across his head, but they weren't sinking into the right holes. And I recognized that when he came out of hospital. So I think that, you know, us parents of children with FASD, sometimes we need to just pat ourselves on the back and say we're very adaptive to behaviors. We learn strategies, and there's a skill there that we're not aware of, that we don't acknowledge enough. So
certainly. And being that adaptive, that's the key, is to understand FASD as a brain injury, then get the right neurobehavioral brain-based approach. And then even if you think you've got that down, you're still adapting moment by moment, because what's the developmental capacity of my child? Like, is he chronologically he's 14, but developmentally, is he 6? If he's stressed or ill, he's 3. Yet a 14-year-old, 15-year-old body. So he's strong and he's angry and he's got hormones. So what am I flexing and adapting to? You know, it's a bit, you know, I'm thinking about Muhammad Ali and, you know, float like a butterfly and sting like a bee kind of an image just came in my mind. You know, we do a lot of that dodging and weaving and trying to hold ourselves in a calm state so that we can be ready to assess and adapt and co-regulate with our kids. And it's exhausting. 8:30 at night, I'm done. I need to go to bed. Like, it's exhausting.
I'm glad you said that, because often it gets to 9:30 and I'm the first one to say, right, I'm going up. And there was a time where I'd have raised an eyebrow at myself for that, but now it just becomes the norm. It's just part of life.
Part of self-care. Self-care. Because, you know, if you run on empty, it's going to fracture. You will fracture, and your family will as well. Gentlemen, thank you so much for this time. I feel like I have new friends. I look forward to another conversation. When you have some big announcement, you know, you've got this hub up, let me know and we can celebrate that on the podcast. I would love that.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be fantastic.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Well, my thanks again to Scott and to Tristan for making the time to speak with me. I celebrate with them their 1-year anniversary this past September 9th. I hope they had a wonderful party and celebration as they, and also they took some time to reflect on the amazing accomplishments and their goals going forward. Incredible. They want to use their facility for even more, to have it filled up with other community groups that are doing amazing work, such as the addiction group and the suicide prevention group. Their goals to be a national FASD hub and to have a 24-hour helpline for people. Isn't that incredible? My hat goes off to these guys and all the work that they're doing. I just commend them so much. So I, again, encourage you to check out the link in the show notes to learn more. As you heard at the end of that conversation, sometimes we have also as carers and parents, we've got real life health issues that really impact our ability to take care of our kids and to advocate for them. And that's why we talk about it's so important to have self-care and to have a community of support. This is not something that you can do alone. And there's times when we just are not 100% and we need other people to lean on. And so I invite you to join our community of support. It's the FASD Family Life Community. And when you join together, we will deepen our understanding of FASD and build a community of support. Our support group meets monthly. You can subscribe to the FASD Family Life Community for only $20 a month. And there's a link in the show notes to help you to do that. Again, thank you for your time. I know it's so precious. And until next week, remember, the struggle is real. And so is success. I'll speak with you soon.